Hi, everyone. My name is John Carson. I'm the director of the Office of Public Engagement here at the White House. Thanks for joining us. To those of you here in the audience today, thanks of all of you to all of you who are watching on whitehouse.gov/live. We're here today. I'm personally very excited to be here with our two guests to talk about an incredibly important issue that's going on in Africa right now. I want to introduce the two folks that we have with us. Later on, we'll have an opportunity to take your questions on Twitter. Just use the hashtag AskFWD. I will be watching for your questions, and I will be retweeting them from my account at JohnCarson44 as well as at whitehouse.gov/live. The two folks we have with us today are first here from the White House, Gail Smith, Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for the National Security Council, and also the Administrator of USAID, Dr. Raj Shah. I just want to personally say how thrilled I am to be here with you today. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Honduras. I got to see firsthand the incredible work, the difference that USAID makes on the ground every single day. And Gail, I've been following your work for a long time. So it's great to be with here. I'd like to open it up by asking Gail to just tell us a little bit and tell our viewers what is happening right now in the Horn of Africa.
Sure, and thanks, John. And it's a delight to be here with you and also with Raj and all of our guests. In the Horn of Africa right now, and this is a part of East Africa, the people of that region are experiencing the worst drought in 60 years, particularly in Kenya, Ethiopia, and Somalia. What that means is that farmers have very little to fall back on and they need our assistance. It's most acute in Somalia, where a number of complexities, the collapse of that government years ago, conflict, the presence of a terrorist organization, Al-Shabaab, have all meant that in parts of Somalia we're actually seeing famine. That's a technical term, but what it means, I think for any of us to understand, is that people are literally dying as we speak. And if they don't get immediate assistance, they will in fact die. This has been a big priority to us and I think many Americans. The United States became aware of this early on due to some early warning that we in USAID and other partners in the international community do so. We pre-positioned assistance. We're now the largest donor both to people in need and also to the many refugees that have come out of Somalia. I just want to flag two things that are important about our response. One is that it's one that engages many agencies in our government, USAID. You will hear from Dr. Shah, our State Department, but also in significantly the White House, the President of the United States, and the Vice President. One of the things we did early on together, Raj and I accompanied Dr. Joe Biden out to the region in August, in part to send a message to the American people. And that message is what gets us to really the heart and soul of why we're here today, which is that in this time of crisis, it's critical that we reach out to people in need. But it is equally important that we seize the opportunity to work with those in the region who have had such success and to build on that success to help build a future for those people that is free of this kind of hunger and vulnerability to the droughts that will come in the future. And I think that's my cue to turn to Dr. Shah and take it from here.
Well, you know, I think Gail has accurately captured the state of play in the Horn of Africa right now. And the result of what is happening is that there are 13 million people who require humanitarian assistance in the Horn as we speak. We know, and this is, it's hard to even process these types of numbers, that already more than 30,000 children have lost their lives, literally from starvation or the consequences of severe malnutrition and disease that accompanies it. And we know that now the United Nations has estimated that that number could grow to 750,000 over the course of the next 6 months. So now is a time to act. And as Gail points out, the United States, under President Obama's leadership and Dr. Jill Biden, have been aggressive about doing everything we can to help save lives. But this is also a moment to acknowledge that when we do these actions, they're an expression of basic American values. And the more Americans that can engage directly in the response, the better off we will all be in saving lives today and in putting in place the kinds of agricultural systems and development partnerships that can help prevent these types of tragedies in the future. So today we're very excited to be launching a campaign together with the Ad Council and so many other partners that have volunteered their resources and time and expertise. The campaign is called FWD, Forward or Famine War Drought. And it is really intended to bring visibility to the challenges that are taking place in the Horn and to invite Americans to be active participants. And here's what you can do. First, you can, a simple action of donating money will help feed children and save lives. You can text the word GIVE, G-I-V-E, to 777-444 and thereby make a $10 contribution to a group of pre-screened U.S.-based nonprofit organizations that are capable of turning your contribution into food for children or vaccines for kids. And $10 might not seem like a lot, but that simple act will help feed a child for nearly 10 days in some of our relief operations in that region. And so we invite that type of participation. But in many ways, more than just providing resources, and that is always necessary, we invite you to go to the campaign site, which is at usaid.gov/FWD. And there you'll find all kinds of information about what's happening right now on the ground. You'll see maps that will show you rainfall patterns, migration patterns, where people have food and where food prices have gone up 200 or 300%. And as a result, children and families essentially don't have access to food. And as you look at those maps and as you look at how you can engage in responding, we invite you to forward the facts, send the information that is out there. Hopefully it's easy to absorb and it makes sense and it's clear, but send it to your church groups, to your student groups, to colleagues and friends and family, because Americans are deeply generous people, and the small actions that we can each take together send a very powerful signal that we not only will stand by people who are literally at the edge of starvation and death, but we will do so in a way that's really American. And I can guarantee you, Gail and I both saw this, when you go and you visit children who have traveled with their mothers for 60, 70, 80 kilometers, they arrive at camps to get food and medicine, and they meet American doctors or they get food out of bags that say from the American people, those people are forever grateful for the fact that they've been touched by American generosity and American commitments. And so we invite you to participate, and I think we're going to show you some of the advertisements or some of the public service announcements that have been created to help bring visibility to the opportunity to save lives that exist today.
Well, thank you, Gail and Dr. Shah. Let's turn to those public service announcements right now and have everyone take a look at them.
Over 13 million people are affected by famine, war, and drought in the Horn of Africa.
When you hear about suffering on this scale, you feel powerless.
But there's hope, because saving lives doesn't take a lot.
It just takes a lot of us.
Text a donation of $10, but do more than donate. Forward the facts to everyone you know.
Forward from our site.
Forward on Facebook.
And forward on Twitter.
We are the relief.
Sharing pictures and videos is something we do every day.
Now that simple act of sharing could save over 13 million people affected by famine, war, and drought in the Horn of Africa.
Text a donation of $10, but do more than donate.
Forward the facts to everyone you know.
Forward from our site, forward on Facebook, and forward on Twitter.
Forward them like you forward random videos of celebrities. We are the relief.
Thanks so much, Gail and Dr. Shah, and those were very powerful and moving PSAs. At this point, we'd like to take questions. We'll start with a question or two here from our live audience today. Yes.
Hi, I'm Adam Saylor with World Vision. First, I want to thank Gail and Dr. Shah for your leadership. Many of us look at the acute crisis in the Horn and see an opportunity to bring greater urgency to the larger issue of food security that both of you have been a leader on. And I'm wondering, in particular, leading into the G20 summit that's coming up next week, how food security is going to be addressed by the president in the midst of that summit, and how can we use that summit as a way to advance a larger food security agenda?
I'll take that. Thank you, Adam, and thank you for all that you do. One of the things President Obama did shortly after coming into office, and interestingly, at the time of the London G20 summit, was called on the world to create an international food security initiative. At that time, we were seeing spikes in world food prices that disrupted people and economies around the world and had a huge impact here at home. Subsequent to that, there was a major initiative launched at the G8, adhering to a number of principles that I think are really important, and I just want to flag, because it wasn't just about our giving aid to countries so that they would be more food secure. It was about investing in the solutions that give us food security. So that meant countries having their own plans and owning those plans. It meant those of us who are donors coordinating in a way that made us more strategic and effective. It meant investing in the research, science, technology that can give us solutions that are the sort of force multipliers that really get us to scale. It meant working collectively to attract other, if you will, investors in the future of not just smallholder farmers, but entire agriculture and economic systems that allow people to be less vulnerable than we see them today in the Horn. That initiative has evolved into something called Feed the Future, which is led by USAID, but is an intergovernmental enterprise and one that I think is one of the most important features of our entire development agenda. The G20 provides a forum to deal with food security in a number of ways, because one aspect of food insecurity for people is when the prices start moving around. Raj mentioned, for example, that in the Horn we've seen a huge increase in prices, so that if you're what's called a subsistence level farmer and you just produce enough to get by day to day and the price doubles, you run out really quickly and you have to fall back on any reserves or rely on the international community. So what are the things that we can do collectively at the level of the G20 about that? I'm pleased to tell you that in a very, very robust development agenda for the G20 that was agreed by leaders at the Seoul Summit last year, two of the things we have focused on this year, not at the exclusion of others but as priorities, are food security and a separate question of infrastructure in the developing world. And I think you will see that food security will remain high on the agenda, that you will see evidence that we are working in the G20 to do something that sounds kind of bureaucratic but makes a difference, which is link together all of these systems that are now in different parts of the world. So I have some information, Adam has other information, people in Ethiopia might have different information, to make sure that we collectively can better track and monitor in ways that allow us to do what we did in the Horn, which was get ahead of the curve. That we look at other things like how we can affect markets on agriculture, how we can strengthen the ability of poor people around the world who are so adversely affected by these spikes, but who importantly are working people, to make sure that the product of their work is sufficient to feed their families and feed their future. So it's on the agenda, and you will see it there in France.
Can I add something briefly? If you go to the website, the USAID.gov/FWD, and one of the maps will have food prices throughout the Horn of Africa, and you'll see in the places where kids are really suffering and dying at rates that qualify as famine, the food prices have gone up 200, 300, even more percent. You can see the data right there on the map. There are parts of Kenya and Ethiopia where you won't see such dramatic increases. You see increases, 60, 70%. And in one instance, at least, in Western Kenya, a big part of the reason for that is a Feed the Future partnership with not just the United States, but the US, the World Bank, the government of Kenya, and some local seed companies have helped get improved hybrid maize varieties to small farmers that are now producing three times the level of food that they were producing just a few years ago. And that's helping to protect hundreds of thousands of people in that part of Kenya, even during a very, very, very severe drought. So these programs can work, and they can reduce the pressure on the humanitarian needs at critical times like this if we're smart enough and focused enough to make those investments up front and do them in a way that really delivers concrete results.
Thanks to both of you. For those of you following again on whitehouse.gov/live, you can ask your questions by on Twitter using the hashtag AskFWD. I'll go to a question that I think is a really good one from Michael Bellavia via Twitter. He asks, how can these issues be addressed when war is a daily occurrence in the Horn of Africa?
You know, one of the things that you see in these crises that's really, really powerful is people's resilience. So, you know, even in Somalia, where things are so difficult, there is an entrepreneurial spirit, a community spirit, a history and tradition of collective action, which means that communities come together to care for those that are in the weakest position. So there's no question that conflict or the circumstances in Somalia make it difficult, make it a very, very dangerous environment for relief workers and obviously for the people who reside in those areas. But I think one of the things we've learned in the Horn of Africa and around the world, that what is never dampened is that resilience, so that there is always a way, even though obviously it is much, much harder and the situation is made much, much worse when you've got a conflict. There are always and still ways to both get to people, but to build on what people continue to do for themselves, even in the most adverse of circumstances.
And in fact, if you look at the partners that we've assembled, so that when you make a text contribution through this campaign, the resources go to a number of groups, all of whom are currently able to reach people in various parts of Somalia. And some groups, like the American Refugee Committee, are a Somali-American-led organization that has just deep roots and deep knowledge about how to reach communities through partnerships with local NGOs. So we know it's a very difficult operating environment, and it's very dangerous, and these are the heroes that are on the front line of the response. But we also know that they're able to reach people in need, and that's why they've been selected to be part of this effort.
Let's take another question from our audience. Yes? Microphone.
I'm Sam Worthington from Interaction, and I would like to applaud this campaign that the U.S. government has launched in. And one of the core questions that Americans always ask is, well, you know, can my $10 make a difference? And in launching this campaign, USAID and the U.S. government are showing both a partnership with the American people, with nonprofits, and with corporations. So how are you working differently to ensure both immediately addressing needs of people, but also addressing the long-term, potential long-term solutions so that we don't find ourselves in the same place 10 years from now?
We've had a lot of similar questions to that on Twitter, so.
Good. Well, you know, immediately, I think the whole community of people that are working on this response are trying a lot of innovations that are making a real difference. They're a little bit more market-oriented, using local markets and other means to get resources to people who are vulnerable and rely on local markets to get food around difficult to access places. We learned from prior famines that actually you lose a lot of children and kids die from health and disease. And so we've expanded efforts to vaccinate children through a range of partners and really prioritize some of what we call therapeutic feeding. It's taking a very malnourished child who often, you know, won't be able to eat by mouth, but needs to be fed through their nose, through a nasogastric tube, and then advance them on to very high protein, high micronutrient, ready to use therapeutic foods that are proven to be more effective. So there are a lot of great innovations that allow us to save lives more efficiently in the context of immediate relief. And just as those exist there, they also exist in the context of the longer term. Gail jokes about my affinity for orange flesh sweet potatoes. But in the Horn of Africa, there are far too many children who are deficient in vitamin A. And as a result, they can suffer blindness, they can get diarrheas, they get sick more easily, and they're more vulnerable. The Kenyan Agricultural Research Institute, actually working with their regional partners, developed an orange flesh sweet potato that kids love to eat even more because it's softer and sweeter. And it has beta-carotene, which is a precursor of vitamin A. Well, we actually studied the blood levels of kids who started eating that sweet potato and found that they became vitamin A sufficient. And, you know, like that, there are hundreds of examples of things we're doing differently to make sure we get nutrition and food security to people who are very, very vulnerable. And those things can be very cost effective and very efficient in the way they generate the results we all seek.
I would only add to that, and it's a good question, Sam. I think we're seeing more and more evidence of something that helps us do that collectively, which is focus on the short term and the long term. And for the record, I love Raj's sweet potatoes. But I think it's a great example of the short term and the long term. That's something that in the short term brings more nutrition to more kids more quickly, but in the long term is potentially a higher value in nutritional terms for farmers to produce in a good year. So it's kind of a twofer, if you will. But there's a story embedded in the story of this famine and drought that's really important, which is that in Ethiopia, for example, and Ethiopia is a country that has seen more than its share of famines and human suffering over many years. There are 8 million people who are affected by this worst drought in 60 years, but who don't need our assistance. And it's because, much like what Raj described in Western Kenya, they have been able to do things we have been able to, and others in the international community, to do things with them so that they're not vulnerable. Those things are ongoing even as we mount the response on the relief side of the equation. So we are actively working with governments in the region to strengthen the East African agricultural market, for example. We are actively working to expand some of the programs that work that Raj has described. AIDS done a terrific job of finding ways with other partners to bring into the relief response some of these highly nutritional products and goods that have been developed, again, that have dual benefit. The other advantage we have in this that I think is really quite exciting is that the involvement of people in the region is extensive. There's a texting campaign in Kenya. There are people organized all over the region, Ethiopians for Ethiopians, and so on and so forth. So there's a very vibrant commitment of people in the region, which is just like us, to say we have to respond now, but we've got an equal obligation and an opportunity to invest in the future. So I think all the stars are aligned to do the two things at once and kind of break out of a cycle where when people are in desperate need, we rush to help them, which is right, and I think something we as Americans will always do, but at the same time to invest so that cycle spreads and eventually disappears.
Well, I want to thank everyone, first of all, who are folks are retweeting and forwarding along the link as we sit here. Thanks to everyone doing that. We have a question from via Twitter from Women Thrive to Dr. Shah. What is the U.S. government strategy for an integrated effort to address gender-based violence as part of the overall efforts in the region?
Well, that's a great question. We actually love working with Women Thrive on a broad range of things. In Just Feed the Future, for example, ICRW, a research organization focused on women, and Women Thrive have helped us create a women's index that ensures that our programs and our efforts target women, that women benefit more from the income gains in these kinds of agricultural programs. And we do that because we know that when women have higher incomes, they're far more likely to invest it in their children and in their children's education, welfare, and nutrition. So you get more bang for buck by making sure that women are the primary beneficiaries of these types of efforts. During crises like these, there is a huge amount of violence targeting women. And Gail and I both met with a group of women who had just completed a 70 or 80 kilometer trek to the Dadaab refugee camp. And many, probably most of the women we met had been attacked, abused, robbed on the way on that walk. And you know, but they are so strong and resilient. What we're trying to do is in the settlements and in the camps, make sure there are safe places for women, and there's a whole set of things that you can do to make sure that women are protected in those types of settings. Frankly, the whole world needs to do more to protect passage for these women when they both get to the Kenyan and Ethiopian borders and then get beyond those borders to settlements. And we just always need to be doing more to make sure that women are protected from violence during crises like this, because this is when they're most vulnerable and when you see big, big spikes in targeted violence against women.
A similar question from Alexander via Twitter. What about fighting corruption as a means of fighting hunger?
Well, you know, when Gail was describing the Feed the Future program, she pointed out that this isn't just about our assistance. This is about countries doing things differently, like developing their own plans, working more effectively with their private sector, and unlocking their own potential through tough but important reforms. And part of that is making sure that they are not just fighting aggressively and effectively corruption, but making sure that they're increasing their own investments in agriculture and in food security. So when Gail talked about Ethiopia, they've more than doubled over the last few years as we've launched this partnership, their investment in their own agricultural productivity and their own food security programs. The same is almost true, not quite true, for Kenya and for many of the other partner countries. And, you know, we've insisted that at a time when, you know, U.S. taxpayer dollars are scarce and precious, we have to make sure that other countries are doing the right things to be good partners, to deliver better results, and that we're holding people accountable for the way those programs are implemented.
I would just add to that, you have to fight corruption, quite frankly, to get any real success in development. Because otherwise, you know, corruption just eats away at any progress you might make. And when the president went to Ghana early in his administration and gave a speech there about kind of a vision of development, a centerpiece of that was an environment where corruption is not on the table and where transparency and accountability dominate. And I think we've seen great strides, I think, on the ground in a lot of countries. I don't want to minimize the fact that corruption is a huge problem everywhere in the world, but I think by the same token, the same social media that allow people to text or send questions through Facebook also allow citizens to hold their governments more accountable in much of the developing world. And I think sometimes we underestimate the power of social media, even in environments where the reach of technology might not be as far, but it's much farther than I think many of us think. So that's number one. I think we're also seeing a growing number of governments who themselves recognize that corruption undermines their ability to govern well or their ability to be development leaders. So we're seeing progress there. We as an administration have made transparency and working on corruption a priority in a number of ways. I don't want to divert our discussion here. There's something I'll just briefly mention, though, called open government, which is a key priority of our president in terms of the way our own government operates. But it's based on the simple premise that governments should be open to their citizens and citizens should be able to hold their governments accountable. At the United Nations, we launched with 8 other governments a global open government partnership with countries from all over the world. And we had 5 in Africa that want to join the partnership. They include Kenya and Tanzania, both in this region. And by joining, they made a commitment to going even further on open governance. So I think we're seeing progress, but I think it's an absolute given that if you really want to see food security or development in any other sphere, you've got to focus on corruption, accountability, and transparency.
An interesting question via Twitter from Dr. Shipley. What long-term effects will we see in the Horn of Africa, in the U.S., in the world, if this crisis is ignored by the global community?
You start.
Well, you know, I'm so glad, Dr. Shipley, wherever you are, that you asked that question, because it's easy at times like this to think of this work as primarily humanitarian. You see children, you want to save their lives. And it's very easy, and so many of us think that's enough to motivate action. But the reality is that this is an area and a part of the world where groups like Al-Shabaab are explicitly connected to Al-Qaeda, where we have a choice to make. Either we can engage based on our values and build friends and supporters and people who will be more prosperous partners for us to trade with, and thereby creating jobs in our own country, or things will go the other way, and there'll be more extremism, more threat emanating from this region to our country and more instability in a part of the world that is increasingly critical. And it's no surprise that the intelligence community and the military community rely on data from the famine early warning system that Gail was referring to earlier to make judgments about how stable the region is and which parts of the region need special attention and effect. So, you know, often our entire development program is less than 1% of our federal budget. And the power of that 1% to keep us safe, to keep us economically prosperous in a world where most growth occurs outside of our borders, and to showcase what America's really about and what Americans really value, is so beyond that percentage that we try to make that point all the time, and we appreciate you raising it.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Shipley. A couple things I'd say, if the international community doesn't kind of do the needful here, there are a few things, and one I'm hesitant to say as I sit next to a medical doctor who's an expert in this, but I know that one of the impacts on kids of malnutrition is it's a lasting deficit. So we're going to see kids who are hurt for their whole lives, families and communities who are hurt for their entire lives. So there's a profound legacy in that. I think a second thing that we will see if the world doesn't stand up is that we will have failed on our kind of key moral values. And I think that for this country, it's important that we stand up, but the fact of the matter is we are. If you look at the response from the American people to this disaster, to Haiti, it's extraordinary. Even in times of economic hardship in the United States, the people who reach into their pockets and provide $5 or $10 or whatever they may do to volunteer in some way to just give a little bit. And it's critically important for the whole world that we hang on to that. Just a quick note on that, which I think is a real ray of hope. One of the great things we've seen in the response to this, we're the world's leader in the response, but we're not alone. So donations have been made to the relief effort by all the countries you might expect, but also by Tanzania, by Ghana, by Africa's newest country, which is South Sudan, has made a contribution. So there are members of the international community far and wide reaching out. I think the last thing we will see if the world doesn't step up is we'll see this movie again. And part of the reason there is a cycle of suffering in that part of the world, some of it's governance, some of it's conflict, so on and so forth, but one of the things it is the tendency of the world to reach out big when people are starving and then recede back afterwards. And so what we're doing now, it's a top priority for the United States government, for the president, for AID, for our State Department, for everybody, but also many of our partners in the international community, is reaching out to help people now, but also investing in their future at the same time. Because we don't want to be in this cycle forever, and they don't either. I'll just share with you one anecdote that captures this. A good friend of mine, an Ethiopian, who during the last really, really big famine in Ethiopia some years ago, was at a meeting where many of the donors said, you know, this has gone on too long and we're afraid we're getting donor fatigue. And he said, trust me, I've got beggar's fatigue. And that's what I think we're all talking about here today, is united, we can end both of those and go forward, FWD.
Probably not surprising via Twitter. We have a lot of retweeting of your quote, Gail. Social media can allow us to ask questions and engage and hold governments more accountable. A lot of fans of that on Twitter. We've had some people join us and ask the question. I think this is a good example of it from Sally via Twitter, really asking, what can people do? So how, specifically from Sally, how can American students and universities best contribute to USAID's humanitarian efforts in the Horn of Africa?
Well, that's a great question. I know that universities in particular and students have been so active already through universities fighting world hunger, and I think Harriet Giles is here. We have the World Food Program and its War on Hunger campaign that has more than 200 colleges and universities. So your college or university or student group could certainly participate in those activities. But let me suggest that you also really do go to the site at usaid.gov/FWD. And you know, amongst the different options there, you can donate, you can forward information to your friends and colleagues. You can also pull the infographics and the maps off of there and build your own sites and tell the story in your own way. And I just learned this, I think it's very cool, is that if you do that, we're going to keep updating the data. As soon as we get the next round of famine data, as soon as we get the next round of market price data, of rainfall data, and those maps will magically update on your sites, in your emails. It won't just be static on our website. And the idea is to build a community, not just of government agencies or employees that are trying to communicate about what's happening, but to use and unlock the creativity of American students across this country to figure out how to pull that data together, tell stories, come up with creative ideas for addressing the crisis, and just engage. And we want you to be active and involved and informed, and we want to ourselves model open government by making all the data that we get through all these various systems available in an open source platform for you to engage with. And maybe you'll figure out things when you look at patterns of rainfall and food production that the experts haven't thought through. Certainly, that's happened time and time again in almost every other industry, so we'd expect some real breakthroughs from the universities, too.
And I think that's a really important point. One of the great things that USAID has done, and they did it on health, but I think there's more planned, is a grand challenge, which is providing information and a problem to people and then letting people think about those solutions. And I would be surprised if out of this campaign and other things like this, we didn't see some solutions start to emerge, not just from universities, but I think because universities are places of learning and people are organized to do that. I think that's one of our hopes, is that we'll see people come in with ideas, whether about ways to aggregate the data or actual solutions on the ground.
An interesting question about youth on sort of the other side of this. What is USAID doing to empower the youth in the Horn of Africa? What efforts are being introduced to incorporate youth to have input to the solutions?
Well, that's a great question, and Gail sort of spoke to it. I think increasingly we're trying to do more and more of our work in a way that partners deeply with institutions, including universities and youth-based institutions, in the places where we do the work. And it has, for far too long, you know, development solutions have been crafted in Washington or London or Brussels and then implemented by organizations also based in those places. And President Obama and Secretary Clinton and all of us have been passionate about saying, let's unlock the energy that exists and the ingenuity that exists in the places that are close to where the challenges are. And when you do that, you get some shocking results. There's a company called Ushahidi that learned how to map water access in the Kibera slum in Nairobi that we actually partnered with to map food and water access in the immediate aftermath of the Port-au-Prince earthquake in Haiti. Not because they were, you know, based in Kenya, but because they were the best people who knew how to reach, using text messages and mobile technology, people who rely on that as their main form of information, when many of, you know, American partners or European partners didn't quite have that system ready to go fast enough. We're also working through companies like Pepsi with tens of thousands of chickpea farmers in Ethiopia. And they're creating the new therapeutic foods, including, it's not called hummus for some reason.
It's humanitarian hummus.
It's humanitarian hummus that'll be enriched and micronutrient enriched for kids. But it just shows you that a country that has been associated so much with famine and with suffering can also really be part of the solution going forward in a very dramatic way. I think that's the future of development. I think a lot of the partners we're trying to work with are embedded in the entrepreneurial communities in those parts of the world.
Well, thank you so much again to everyone who is retweeting, forwarding along these links. We're going to end with one question that I think is really important, and you've touched on this a little bit, but for all the people who've watched today, for those of you in the audience who care about these issues, who want to work on it, what's the best way to explain this, explain the seriousness of it, to average Americans who, in a difficult time in this country, are thinking about their own economic situation? If you were convincing a friend, a neighbor, to be a part of the solution, how would you explain it to them?
You know, I don't think there's any one way to engage your friend or your neighbor in this effort. To me, the moral case, the fact that you can make a $10 contribution inside of a minute on your mobile phone while walking to wherever you're going, is enough to say that every American ought to do that. And when we act collectively like that, more than half of all Americans gave to the relief effort in Haiti, you can literally see and feel the emotional gratitude and the actual result on the ground. I know that for some that are in our national security and military community, they will appropriately find our former Secretary, Secretary Gates's comments that it is cheaper to do development than to send soldiers to be compelling, because they're on the front lines of being the soldiers that then have to go and take huge personal risks in order to keep our country safe. And just earlier last week, we heard from a group of CEOs of major American companies that spoke about how they partner with USAID and with this administration's development work because they think most of global growth is going to come from these parts of the world, and the sooner they can be present and active in those parts of the world, the better off they will be. And they've been proven right by South Korea and Taiwan, which were both major food aid recipients. And South Korea today, this year, is hosting the big international meeting on setting standards and best practices in development themselves. So I think there are a lot of compelling reasons, but I would just urge you to give it your best shot. We've tried to make all this data available and to make this very accessible, because we know that the power of your voice to your friend, to your neighbor, to your church group, in your university, is more powerful than the power of our voice in that same community. And if you were to give the 10, 20 minutes it might take to look at the site, to construct your own version of something, to download the graphics, and to forward with your own individual reason for why you think your colleagues should care and engage, you'll be exercising a basic American value of generosity and compassion and engagement in the world. So thank you.
I would agree with all of that, and particularly with there's no one way to do it. But I think just three ways to think about it. One is, you know, Raj points out it's in our interest. It's in our economic interest, it's in our moral interest, and it's in our security interest. But it's also, you know, at a time when there's hardship around the world, where there's tension between and among peoples, seizing on our common humanity is a pretty powerful thing. And it's not a choice. It doesn't mean that if you provide $10 for a mother struggling to survive in Somalia that you don't also turn to your neighbor in Pittsburgh or in California or elsewhere. So it's that notion of a global community where we all stand with each other. I think the last thing is tell a story. When Raj and I traveled with Dr. Biden, she said she went as a mom, that as a mother, she saw these stories and she just said, wait a minute, this is wrong. And her power in terms of conveying what's happening and what can be done is simply that as a mother. She tells a story and people hear it. And I think what we know from disasters around the world, from the generosity of the American people as we've seen for decades, is that when you tell people stories, they listen, and when you give them the facts and they know, they act. So I think that's all we need to do is tell the story. Forward's got the facts, and I think if we just reach out that collectively we can do what needs to be done here in the best way possible.
Well, thank you so much, Gail. Thank you so much, Dr. Shah. Thanks so much to the organizations that are represented here who have staff on the ground in the Horn of Africa right now, to your incredible staff who are doing this work every day. Thanks to everyone who is retweeting, forwarding along. Remind your friends and neighbors, if they there's lots of great information here. If they just use hashtag AskFWD, they'll be able to follow this along. You can follow Dr. Shah on Twitter, at Raj Shah. You can follow me and ask questions later on, at John Carson 44. Thanks, everyone, so much for your time today.